Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. It's a bonus edition this week, the 2020 budget edition. More than 5 months delayed with the pandemic, Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has declared Australia will not fall on its knees despite facing the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression. In his 2020 budget, business appears to come out the major winner, along with people who need upskilling and, of course, workers who will receive tax cuts. But is it going to be enough? With the $100 billion JobKeeper stimulus planned to roll off in March, coupled with non-existent foreign immigration and headwinds for the Australian property market, can Scott Morrison's supply-side budget solve the imminent demand deficits? Here to run through our thoughts on the Corona budget and to discuss how they may be incorporated in our portfolios, I'm joined by Nucleus Wealth's Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Also on the line, we have our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hi, David.
G'day, Tim.
And also joining us, we have our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen. Hello to you, Leith.
G'day, Tim.
Wonderful. Good to have you all on. And just a quick reminder that before we get started, to subscribe on YouTube and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the chat boxes at either nucleuswealth.com/webinar or the YouTube's comments box to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into the agenda for today. So we're, of course, going to be facing off straight away into the budget numbers and policies, looking then at the economic impacts, looking across to then market impacts and also political impacts, and then finally wrapping up, as we always do, with an investment outlook and how we use these themes every day here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So to kick us off, I'll hand over to our Chief Economist, Leith Van Onselen, to pick up on the budget numbers and policies, Leith.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I thought I'd give everyone a quick overview of the federal budget, which was obviously delivered last Tuesday night. And I guess, you know, just look at the broad strokes here. The federal budget projects a deficit of $214 billion this financial year. So that's 2020-2021. And then also that budget deficit then projected to halve over the following financial year. So although those are obviously big numbers and that provides a fair bit of fiscal support to the economy, the fiscal support is actually going to get pulled back over coming years, which will obviously pull out money out of the economy. Now, in terms of, you know, policy measures, budgets always include lots of them. There's in fact dozens of policy measures, but basically there's only really three major ones that are of much note. First of all, and this is probably the most interest to most listeners, the federal budget brought forward the stage two tax cuts, and they also those were meant to come in I think next financial year, if not the one after, and those have been pulled forward into this current financial year, and they're actually allowed to be claimed right now. So to last financial year. So you can effectively claim them retrospectively. And what this means is that basically around 7 million taxpayers, once you do your tax return for the last financial year, the one just gone, they'll around 7 million taxpayers will receive about $2,000 to $2,500 each back on their tax. So that's obviously additional household disposable income. So yeah, yippee. On top of that, there's also... the other big policy.
I think it's backdated only to last July, right?
Yeah, that's right. But they can.
They only expect. It's about a $17 billion policy, but they only expect seven of it in this present financial year.
Yeah. So that would be
PAYG and various other shenanigans, right?
Yeah, that's right. So basically, instead of waiting till next the financial year, the end of this financial year, so June next year, they've basically brought it back, so you can claim it now and get some money now. And the whole idea behind that was just basically to give to boost household disposable income now, give people extra purchasing power, et cetera, to try and boost demand. the next big, I'll go back into the implications of this a bit later on, but the next major policy announcement was that small, medium and large businesses with turnovers of up to $5 billion will be allowed to write off the full value of any eligible asset up until June 2022, so for the next two financial years. And that policy is obviously designed to bring forward business investment and, you know, to boost growth and productivity, et cetera, et cetera. Finally, the only other policy which was really worth any note was the job maker credit, hiring credit. So effectively, we know that the job seeker supplement's going to roll off January 1. So effectively, that's going to fall by another $250, the supplement, per fortnight from January, the upcoming January. And also the job keeper scheme is also expected, is legislated to finish in March next year, and it's going to taper over that period. So those will be replaced by something called the Job Maker Hiring Credit, which I affectionately like to call Profit Keeper. And what that basically allows is any major enterprise, so that basically means businesses other than the major banks, that hire younger Australians aged between 16 to 35 will receive a subsidy for hiring those workers. And that subsidy is going to be paid at the rate of $200 per week for those who are aged under 30 and $100 per week for those aged between 30 to 35. And that's obviously designed to try and bring down the very high youth unemployment. And obviously Australia's youth have been hit very hard by the COVID-19 pandemic. And so it's designed to boost employment and encourage firms to obviously employ more young people. And the Australian Treasury estimates that this will support about 450,000 jobs for young people. Now, unfortunately, what the budget was more notable for what it didn't include. What I was hoping to see, and what I know Dave was hoping to see, was an increase in the job seeker unemployment benefit. So that was increased temporarily by $500 per fortnight when COVID-19 hit, and that $500 supplement ran through from March through to September 30 or September 27, and it's now been tapered down by $250, so about halved. And from January 1, job seekers supposed to fall back to its old level of pitiful level, I should say, of $40 per day from January 1. Now, Australia's unemployment benefits were already the very lowest in the OECD before the COVID-19 pandemic hit. They were about 30% below the poverty line. So from January 1, everyone who's unemployed and is on JobSeeker is going to have basically $40 a day to live on, which is a very significant oversight of the budget. Also, the budget included bugger all for public works projects, so it had very little in the way of infrastructure, effectively nothing in the way of public housing and social housing. Had a few bits of scraps, but basically this was effectively a supply side budget that had, you know, obviously money provided a little bit of demand support in tax cuts, obviously tried to spur on some business investment, and is trying to spur on you know, employers to hire more young people through the job maker credit. But, you know, it was really not a lot in there. And the way I characterised this budget when it came out was really a first and second year, the type of budget you see in the first or second year of a new government. So it's not, you know, when they obviously don't need to pork barrel the electorate, it was very conservative. The major problem with it is that because we've got JobKeeper getting cut and it'll be gone by March 1 next year, and because the job seeker supplements are expected to disappear, and we also have that there are a bunch of other small measures, like, for example, Australians have been able to access $10,000 of the superannuation in the first half of this year and $10,000 in the second half of this year. That's now going to disappear. Because all those measures are basically rolling off, Australia's facing what we call a ginormous fiscal cliff, which is effectively all the supports that we've had in the 6 months leading up to late September, they've already been cut by about 40% with the cut in the JobSeeker and JobKeeper supplement. And from January next year, they're supposed to be about two thirds less than what they were in the first 6 months.
And, so are we on this next slide? Is that where you're looking?
Sorry, yes,
we're going to spend. But it's probably just worth for anyone listening in. We've got a couple of slides up there, and it's worth just noting. You know, there's three charts. The first one is sort of showing that the fiscal cliff from third quarter 2020 to fourth quarter is quite dramatic. Sort of drops from spending over 100 billion to back to maybe about 30, and then falling away from there. And then another one's just sort of showing the stimulus withdrawals. And in particular, of note is that so at the end of October is when there's a big, I think about a 38% drop in terms of the amount of spend. And then there's another drop sort of brings it back to, well, it's total 67%, but it doesn't, I think it's probably cumulative, I'm guessing, in January. So there's sort of two big drops, one in October through to November, and then the other one in from December to January, where there's big drops. And then the final part is that poverty line stuff Leith was talking about, just showing that the job, the new start and JobKeeper is basically miles below the poverty line, and the gap is widening.
That's right. It's also way below the age pension, so it's a bit of a lost opportunity. And effectively, by mid next year, all this temporary support, you know, excluding the tax cuts, but all the JobKeeper, jobs, etc., is expected to be gone, fully gone. So that's all that money that households have been receiving while they've been unemployed or obviously, you know, furloughed from their jobs, is gone. And that's the budget, and the main problem is the Australian private sector has already been in recession since I think September last year, since December last year. So we've had the December quarter, the March quarter, and the June quarter. The private sector was already in recession.
Leith, I just should qualify that for anyone listening in, is what Leith means is that the only reason why the GDP, Australia's GDP didn't go backwards was because government spending was bailing it out for those two quarters.
Yeah, so there's a chart on the next page which Dave can speak to in a second, but it's worth having a look at. What I've done there is we've got final demand. So final demand's a better measure of economic growth in Australia. GDP is the one usually used, but GDP includes obviously net exports and net imports. But if you want to look at just spending within the economy, final demand's a much better expenditure. Much better measure. And final demand was
Leith, before you get off that, can we just talk this some of this the JobKeeper, job seeker stuff? Because I'm interested to see this. You know, we've got some of these big drops within the in terms of these wage subsidies that have rolled off. I thought it was actually so I guess this must be a cash flow payment this is talking about, because I thought it finished at the end of September, but I guess the cash flow continued on into October. Is that what it's suggesting?
Yeah, so it's a bit strange. Like these charts tend to be lagged by a month.
Yeah.
So I think because employers can claim they basically claim it in arrears. So they're always a month ahead. So effectively, if the ATO's handing out payments for September, the payments go through into the economy in October. So
right,
it's basically it's basically a 1 month lag, and it's the same where you can see that the stimulus falls really in February, when in fact JobKeeper and JobSeeker supplement actually end or they get cut or end on December 31 thereabouts.
And then there's a jump up for Q3 next year, which is the. I'm not sure what that's.
Tax cuts.
Is that another? Oh, okay. That's another set of tax cuts coming through as people actually take those payments. Right. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So effectively, these two charts, the first and second chart on this page, are effectively the same data presented in a different way. Data set in a different way. So one's from UBS, one's from McKinsey, and we could have put a third one from Grattan, but they all tell the same story. That effectively, you know, from next month, we're going to start seeing the economy is start. So from November, the economy is going to start seeing a big reduction in household disposable income because of these pullbacks in
And if if we're going to put it in an analogy, you know, we're starting a marathon to get out of this, and we've sprinted out of the blocks, and then we're going to slow to a walk once we've
it's
to a crawl, isn't it, really? But the scale of it is pretty immense. Like Q2, Q3, 2020 this year had basically 17% of GDP annualized in giveaways. Mm. And we're going to take those back over the subsequent three quarters, actually. So in other words, public demand, to its contribution to growth is just about to go backwards, 17% of GDP.
Well, yeah, but also, though, I mean, there is a decent amount of offset in terms of with, you know, the lockdowns and everything across the country. So it's not,
of course,
yeah,
of course.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so a chunk of that filled a hole, but it obviously overfilled the hole, and yes, now some of that hole, the hole that's sort of left behind, isn't going to fill up, isn't going to go back to where we were, say, last year quickly, but the stimulus side is. So we've gone from overfilling the hole to underfilling the hole.
Yeah, which is a great jumping off point for our next page.
Yeah, it is. So I'll just finish my last point, and then we can segue over to Dave. That's basically the million-dollar question here. So basically, the federal government is banking on, as they pull the stimulus away real quick, that the economy is going to magically do a V-shaped recovery, and they're going to basically pass the baton. So the unemployed people are going to suddenly go into job, they're going to go from being welfare into work, etc. And we're not going to get this big demand shock. But you know, we can't see that happening smoothly. And Dave can talk to that with the next chart. Final demand.
Yeah, okay. So there's a range of reasons listed here why we think that this will be much more problematic than Treasury and the Treasurer hope. But the number one driver is traditional Keynesian stimulus, which is what the media has largely represented this budget as, is designed to offset retrenching private sector spending and investment decisions. Like when they go backwards because of fading confidence, et cetera, and maybe balance sheet problems, whatever they happen to be, then there's just too much uncertainty. Then the government steps in with direct spending and investment. And in fact, there's a blog post today, we didn't put any of the material in here, but from the IMF, with its incredibly large database showing the history of Keynesian countercyclical stimulus and how it works when you have uncertainty inhibiting the private sector. And what the government has done is simply taken a bet that that won't happen this time in this context, in this country. So, you know, what Keynes called it was the paradox of thrift, when you have difficulty in the private sector and households and businesses start to save, and then you have to find a way to get them to spend again, and that can be quite difficult to do, especially if you don't lead them there with some public spending. So that's the kind of context in which these various headwinds that we've listed here we think pose a problem for the way the budget is structured. So
actually, could I overlay one more over the top of that as well, David? Because there's that the paradox of thrift, as you said, is that this whole thing about, you want to get people spending again to get it going so you can get back to where you were. But we've, and not just Australia, plenty of other economies, but Australia's probably one of the worst around the world, has built an economy not just based on people spending, but actually people borrowing to spend. Like it's been much, much greater than our income for, 20 years. And so, it's actually it's not even just get people confident enough to go and spend. You need to get them confident enough to go out and to borrow in order to spend as well. So that one extra level above what Keynes would have considered.
Quite right. I mean, there are following that enormous public drop of income that we've just discussed, there are some decent household savings that might get unwound a little. It'll help. But we still don't think it'll be enough. So you've got the fiscal cliff, and you obviously have had an unemployment shock that's still quite severe. And while we go off the fiscal cliff over the next 6 months, is unlikely to improve. In fact, it'll very likely get worse. There's various firms that have supported their workers with government help over the last year or so, you know, they come back to work and find that they just simply don't have the demand for their workforce, and so we'll see reduced headcounts. On top of that, I'm in my many business contacts, they all say the same thing about what has just happened during the lockdowns. That is, they all discovered that they were carrying a lot of fat in their processes, their systems, and their factories and their output. And they, you know, once they shut down, they discovered a million and one ways of being more efficient. And so they're obviously going to implement that when they come back. And so that's going to also, it's a big efficiency and productivity boost, but it's definitely going to hit headcount as we reopen as well. Then on top of that, this one is particularly a challenge for Australia, and that is the mass immigration crash, which we're looking at basically negative population growth for 2 years. Is that more or less?
So immigration, net overseas migration, next two financial years is projected to fall by about 100,000. But because of population growth, the natural increase, Australia's population growth is projected next year to grow by only 50,000, and the year after that by about 90,000. But that's down from roughly 400,000.
Yeah.
Previously per year, or, you know, 380 to 400,000. So we're talking about a quarter. More like an eighth of what the population growth we've experienced over recent times.
Have you seen anything, Leith, that tracks the household formation, say? Because I guess in a way, you know, it doesn't really matter if there's a whole bunch of extra kids born because they're being born into households that are already there. It probably matters more about whether, that whole household formation idea about 18-year-olds or 20-year-olds or 31-year-olds nowadays moving out to get their own place.
Certainly, I haven't actually seen any data about that, but anecdotally, you're spot on, because natural increase will come from people having babies, obviously. But more importantly, in times of recession, and this is, you know, throughout history, it doesn't matter what country you look at, in times of recession, you tend to get a higher number of people per dwelling, because obviously kids move back home because they're struggling financially, you have more group houses, et cetera, or kids delay leaving home. And so because of that, you know, obviously having a big reduction in population growth is going to have a bigger impact on you know, housing oversupply. You need to build more dwellings, more everything, because not only do you have less people coming in or less population growth, you've also got less need for dwellings because people are staying home longer, or they're moving back home, or sharing group houses.
So household formation might be negative.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, which brings us to the really important point to make about trying to stimulate supply in the budget, and that is there's oversupply in everything, especially the sectors that are most exposed to mass immigration that have been building out so furiously for the last decade or so. Anyone reading the blog will have seen Lee's fantastic charts on what is an unprecedented residential property oversupply, but there's precisely the same thing is transpiring in all dimensions of commercial property, with work from home, office, oversupply, and vacancy rates are going to go through the roof. Retail's already gone through the roof, and capital prices are plunging in retail. Vacancy rates are through the roof for retail. And so, you know, that's obviously CapEx stuff, but that applies as an analogy pretty much across the entire economy. You've got an oversupply in just about everything. And, you know, then you present a budget which tries to stimulate more supply, which is a very strange way to think about it. And it does so by not by using tax cuts, but by accelerated depreciation for the businesses that Leith discussed. And that isn't a particularly strong incentive either, with interest rates so low, because all you're really saving is, you know, the risk-free rate on foregone future depreciation.
And yeah. So what David means by that is if I want to spend, you know, $1 million today to build a new factory, is that I'd then depreciate that over whatever 10 years and I'd get to pull back my depreciation every year. Whereas now I get to take that 10 years all up front. So I get a big tax kick for this year, but at the expense of a future tax. So it's good. It's a good thing to do, but the question is if my existing factory is only running at 70%, then why do I want to build a new factory?
Yes, exactly. And then the incentive to do it's just not that high. Then you've got the issue of hurdle rates for investment, which are still quite high for most businesses and corporations. And I don't think that these depreciation incentives will be enough to get most decisions over those hurdle rates. And that is, what is the rate of return, expected return on investment?
Except for that one big one, David, that I know you're probably about to get to, but I'll have to jump in and beat you to it, is that with my factory that I'm building, you know, my existing factory needs 300 people to run it. You know, my new factory is only going to need 50 because I'm going to automate everything I can.
Exactly. And
so that's the only one that's worth doing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, so the only reason to invest is to reduce your headcount. is the upshot, which we don't give the wrong impression. Like in normal circumstances, this is quite good and it helps lift productivity and income for the overall economy. But when you're in this circumstance of such slack on the supply side, you've got underutilized stuff across the economy, then the vast majority of businesses are simply going to sweat their existing assets and try and sweat them even harder than they would. Than they were before, rather than expand or put on, you know, new employees. So it's a very kind of ill-conceived targeting of the area of the economy that needs it the least.
Yeah. And the other thing is, so the Australian government's foregone all that revenue. So for this one-off big hit now, but when the guys who's building this factory goes out and buys a whole bunch of machines, he's not buying them from Australians. He may as well cut a check to the US and China to buy the technology because it's not like you've said, here's some money, go and buy it from other Australians and that'll put those guys into work. It's basically, here's some money, go send it overseas.
Yes, that's right. There's one final thing to add, and that is this goes to demand deficit again. Just harking back to the one attempted demand stimulus measure in the budget, which is the tax cut, which typically don't work anyway as a stimulus measure. They're quite often saved. And we did this, in fact, at the end of last year, and it did nothing for consumption. As Lee said, the private sector fell into recession as we did.
And also the national the household savings rate went through the roof after the last tax cut, which just meant people saved.
Exactly. And that was all before COVID, right? So now we're post-COVID and they're going to do it again because, as we know, when you're an ideological nutter, fail the first time, you double down. But the thing is, the tax cut, as the budget numbers themselves say, it's only $7 billion this financial year. All of it, that we have to wait until next July before most of it even arrives. So we're going to have all of these headcount reduction policies over the next 9 months with basically almost no demand stimulus. So it's a real crazy punt, this budget. It's not something that I've basically seen in my lifetime for a budget that landed amid cyclical difficulties, not in any country. And that kind of brings us to the politics of it. Oh, I suppose maybe should we quickly do politics and come back to markets, or should we do markets?
Oh, either way. Yeah, we can jump across to politics if you want.
Yeah, okay. Well, it just sort of segues with the end of that discussion, I guess.
Sure.
So it is a supply side budget without precedent, especially in the cyclical circumstances. It's not Keynesian. The other day I argued it was a bit Austrian. I was being a little tongue in cheek. It's not really Austrian either because it depends very heavily on passing demand to the RBA, which is about loose credit. That's not Austrian. It's wacko trickle down stuff from a wacko trickle down government, which is basically, you know, cut taxes for your mates in the corporate sector and they'll take care of the rest of us. So as a result, we see a very weak recovery next year, especially in wages, and that very much deals Labor back into the election. Sets up the possibility of this being an Abbott-style budget from 2014, where we had our debt and deficit disaster budget in inverted commas, which so smashed confidence, private sector confidence, that Abbott was gone 12 months later as Prime Minister. And so you can't discount the possibility, the distinct possibility of the government doing a very swift U-turn on its own budget. It did put aside a very large slush fund in the budget in the event that it didn't work. I think it was about $50 billion, was it, Lee? Which was reserved for possible new COVID outbreaks, etc. But I wouldn't be surprised if they're forced to use it to bail out their own budget. So politics became...
Yeah, good, yeah, for sure.
An interesting question. So with that background, we can flip back to markets. Which is
Dave, can I just interject for a second? Yeah. You know, is it worth maybe just saying, you know, what they should have done before getting to that? Or
we
could be here all afternoon, couldn't we, if we were going to get what they should have done?
No. I mean, honestly,
it's very straightforward. Yeah, you've touched on half of it already.
Yeah.
You want to boost the automatic stabilizers, so bigger job seeker. And invest and a whole works. Money in infrastructure, public works.
And public housing. Yeah,
public works. That lifts demand, gets then the private sector economy comes in on the back of that, and you start to get into a virtuous cycle.
Labor did R&D is big as well. And R&D, get out and whether it's green or not green, you know, if your political thing can't countenance any green stuff, I'm sure there's some other scientific stuff, things they could...
That is the other obvious thing you would do, which the government has done the complete opposite, is that, and some sort of green infrastructure stimulus as well, which Labor has mooted as an alternative. Instead, they did their energy, you know, unplanned to dig up more expensive gas. Now, that'll be slightly stimulatory in the short term, given they need to employ some more miners and et cetera, but if it won't lower energy prices, it doesn't do anything much.
Just said something real quick. I mean, you know, Infrastructure Australia releases the infrastructure priorities list every year, where it has about 20 projects, which they say these are national priorities. The federal government should simply have just grabbed the first 10 of that or whatever and just said, great, here we go. We're now going to build these X. Simple as that. And gone on a massive public housing spending spree. And that's pretty much that and raising job seeker, the two sort of, you know, talking broad strokes here, the two sorts of things they should have done.
It isn't rocket surgery.
It's not.
You're exactly right. Anyway, so what they've done instead is completely understimulate and encourage business to sack workers. And so, in effect, for the first very serious implication for us then to consider when we start looking at markets is what this does to monetary policy. And it basically leaves demand entirely to the RBA, which is, of course, out of ammunition. So it'll do what it can. It'll include another rate cut. There'll be more QE, there'll be more nationalisation of bank bonds to try and drive down mortgage rates. Maybe it'll move out, it should move out the duration of the bond curve and buy longer dated bonds. And hopefully it will help offset this demand deficit by buying state government bonds as well, where, you know, there'd be more infrastructure investment if they do. But the main point is that This forces the RBA to ease more. A lot of commentary coming out of the supply side and brokers and what have you has taken this completely upside down. And because the government increased the deficits, rather than looking at the quality of what they were doing, they were looking at quantity. A lot of people have said the RBA doesn't need to cut now. That may slow the RBA a little bit, given it's the whole thing is so reactive and conservative, and you know, worried about its reputation and these things. But at the end of the day, the economy is just going to force its hand. We certainly think it will move in November, and I think it'll be forced to move again very quickly in the new year because demand's just going to be so shit. So that sets us up for, you know, probably Australia's last bond bull market, because we still have, you know, quite high yields relative to the rest of the world, and certainly in terms of risk as well, risk adjusted, our bond market is very well priced. The other component of that is the budget was also very aggressive about the impact of vaccines, et cetera, next year. And so it's extremely likely to miss all its targets. And it'll need a lot more to be issuing more debt than it currently thinks it's going to. So that also means that it gets pretty complicated at this point, as we sort of refer to how Australian yields will react to global yields as you know, other nations come out of COVID with the US election and troubles in Europe, with its Brexit, resurgence of COVID over winter and all these places as well. But the basic point to make is that Australian yields are going to fall from here pretty consistently. And you'll probably see, at least once the Dems get in next year, increased fiscal stimulus in the US, which for a time at least is likely to lift US yields as the bond market starts to price in a bit of recovery and a little bit of increased inflation. I'm not certainly not talking about inflation breakout. And so the yield spread between the US and Australia should compress, and indeed it's already inverted again at certain parts of the curve, which will pressure the Australian dollar.
For people who are not sure what that means, so basically that you used to always see that the Australian interest rates were higher than the US interest rates, and that was because Australia needed a lot of capital. That was sort of a bit of a feature, but recently that hasn't been the case.
Yes. So what it's called the carry trade, where people borrow in one currency and then invest it in another, higher interest rates than borrowed it at. But obviously, if you keep lowering your interest rates, you put that off, and so less people buy your currency. So we see the Australian dollar is struggling next year. Difficult to know exactly when it peaks. It'll also rely on commodity prices, etc. But they should be weakening too once, you know, Brazil comes online. But I don't want to get too with iron ore, etc. Let's not get too lost in those factors. But the basic thrust of it is that the budget means the Australian dollar will be lower than it would have been otherwise. So the other thing that kind of leads us directly to from interest rates, of course, is property. And we've already seen, you know, more positive impact on house prices, perhaps, than we expected from the lower interest rates that we've already seen. I don't want to get too carried away with that statement, but certainly the cities where immigration was less important, Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, peripheral capitals, if we call them that, have seen flat and rising prices in the last 6 months, and seem to be warming into some kind of positive cycle. So we expect that will probably continue as the RBA is forced to do more. But the southeast is still in a lot of trouble on all the oversupply that we've described, the difficulty it has with falling immigration, and so it's hard to see, you know, much in terms of bullish price action in the southeast. Melbourne's still really struggling. Sydney's managed to stabilise, but can't see it running too far. But Leith, does that roughly accord with your view?
Yeah, it does. I think obviously Melbourne's going to be the weakest, just because of lockdown, but also we're most immigration dependent, but also Sydney's. Can you guys hear me? Someone's put a jackhammer into my wall. I'll just mute my mic.
Yeah.
So I mean, the economic impact of that is any kind of wealth effect, you know, where people take the newly won or enjoyed equity in their asset prices and cash that in on spending. is likely to be pretty muted. As we said, household savings have been lifting, you know, with all of the generous stuff, fiscal stuff over the last 9 months, but and that's sure to reverse to some extent, which would be a bit supportive. But there's probably not much wealth effect coming through house prices, with some capitals enjoying it, but are being offset by weakness in others. So that goes towards the demand deficit as well, and continues to, you know, weigh towards more RBA easing. And when you get into this circumstance where you effectively at zero interest rates and you're still trying to find ways of lowering mortgage rates, which is what the RBA is now doing by buying Australian bank bonds that they used to sell to the private sector at high interest rates and are now refinancing at the RBA at very low ones, which increases their margins and allows them to cut mortgage rates. That is, you know, a game of diminishing returns because the banks still have 60% of deposits they can't lower anymore. And so every time they cut margin mortgage rates, they lose more margin. And so this is what happened to Japanese banks and European banks through their crises. Basically, bank margins just continually fall away. And you end up, you know, slowly nationalizing your banks on the quiet and eating them and their capacity to issue credit, even as you're trying to save the very asset prices that they've, you know, juiced into such high levels. So it's really the end game for the banks and for your property bubble.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing we didn't talk about is that we started from the basically the second worst position in the world in terms of consumer debt.
Exactly.
So
that's obviously a big headwind as well. So at the moment the Australian banks are ignoring some of these forces, at least for the last week or so. They've had a run as global banks have gone up, and I'm now talking about stocks pretty much. But you know, it's difficult to see that lasting in these circumstances with still a lot of bad debt headwinds, margin pressures from what will need to be an aggressive RBA. And so the banks should struggle. But that's really, I guess, the important thing to note about that for the Australian stocks and stock market is that it's an analogy for suffering from weak domestic demand. So all, you know, anything exposed to Australian domestic demand is going to struggle to increase earnings. And we've been tracking the Q3 reporting across the world, earnings reporting season, and it's shaping up to be pretty good in the US, where the median stock might actually, median earnings at this stage look like they might be on track to replicate 2019, which is, you know, a pretty outstanding recovery for earnings. I mean, I'm not saying it's all perfect getting there.
Yeah, and actually, it was worth prefacing though as well, Dave, say that there's the sector mix is still not, I guess, representative. Like these companies who have seen report so far is very particularly concentrated in some sectors that probably aren't representative of the entire market.
Yes, it would ease. It's not representative yet, but the major point is that relative to Australian earnings, we were still minus 20% on 2019 with almost no lift from the bottom in terms of the outlook, which we pretty much agree with. In other words, in Australian stocks, is through multiple expansion, won't be through earnings. Not impossible, but it obviously makes it a bit more difficult.
We've got a handful of questions that have come in just while we've been running through those markets. So if you want, we can maybe pause and just take those. First one here, so thanks to MD. Do you think both low interest rates now and the now attempted immediate tax cuts with no medium-term infrastructure projects that diversify our economy, do you think that we're going to sabotage a recovery?
Oh, I think that's 100% what this presentation is about. We have sabotaged the recovery. I think the only redeeming feature of the budget is that it put aside $50 billion as a slush fund to throw at the economy if it fails. And I think it will. So,
yeah. I guess I'd probably say though, it's sabotage it in terms of saying if you had have spent it just if you had have just said let's just take everything we're spending on existingly and increase it by a lot to get it. I guess what I'm saying is it's not really sabotage in terms of it's a positive. Like if you did nothing, if you step back and said, okay, we're just not going to do anything, and good luck, guys, we'll get out of this eventually, then that would be that might sabotage your recovery. Like this isn't going to inhibit, it's not going to inhibit the recovery. But really, what it's saying is the amount of money we're spending, you should have done way, way, way better for the amount of money you're spending. Like a lot of it's going to be wasted in terms of sent overseas.
Yes, that's right. But
very low calorie.
Low calorific, but it's also a bad recovery largely because it's so unfair.
Yeah. You know, well, it's just trying to get back to where we used to be. It's assuming where we were was a good spot with lots of debt.
Yeah. If you all you're going to do is encourage businesses to reduce headcount through tax incentives, then what you're going to get is very, very weak wages and you'll get no income growth to push demand, and that'll hit the top line of the same firms. So, you know, there's nothing in here that gives you a virtuous cycle through which to recover. So, I mean, both Morrison and Frydenberg were weirdly defensive a few days after the budget and over the weekend in the press, because the criticism of the budget was pretty meek in the media. Really, MB was the only one that got to the nub of it anywhere near close. But they were like, oh, yeah, if it doesn't work, we'll just do more of the same.
And, yes.
You know, and it was just strange. It's strangely been a very strange budget discussion, post-budget discussion, worryingly so from my point of view, because such an ill-conceived budget demands a robust economic debate, and we haven't had it. Except at MB, don't get me wrong, there's going to be an economic recovery because, you know, Victoria is going to reopen. It's not that we're going to stay in recession, but the recovery is going to suck when it should be a boom, because you've got all this catch-up growth from being shut down, plus then you throw in some appropriate demand stimulus to get people working and lift incomes, get reflation going. You know, this is a deflationary budget that you've launched at completely the wrong moment.
Yep. Yeah, this is the budget maybe not the dollar amount of the deficit, but if you were starting to run into inflationary concerns and wages were growing too quickly,
yep,
you might then launch a similar type of the policy structure in terms of saying how can we get wages down and improve productivity.
Absolutely, that's what Leith was saying before. This is like a mid-cycle.
Yeah.
Where you would do precisely that. And that's why we say it's not that it's intrinsically bad. Like, not at all. It's just the timing.
It's just it's the wrong budget at the wrong time.
Yep.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right. So
yeah. They've loaded enough ammunition into the thing, they've just aimed at it in the wrong direction.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
At their own foot.
All right. Couple more questions, gents, and thanks to everyone that's popping them into the various chats here. So what's the long-term, so in brackets, decade forecast on interest rates? A decade of zero rates, ?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, unlock that in.
The upshot of leaving a demand deficit, leaving the RBA to deal with it through trying to prompt more private debt, is that you are going to have to nationalize the bank's debt and addict everybody to zero interest rates, to zero and eventually negative interest rates. And this is the end of rate hikes forever. Until such a time that somewhere else decides that we need to do, you know, monetarily funded fiscal on such a scale, when we're talking about modern monetary theory, that we actually get some inflation and wage inflation, et cetera, and that we might give us the price of capital back. But the path that this budget takes you down is Japan, endlessly lower interest rates.
And it's worth noting, though, as well, is that the cash rate that the RBA reports is no longer important, in our view. Is what's important is actually the rate on the term funding facility, TFF. Anyway, so what that is that's the one which lets banks, so the RBA gives this to banks, and banks can then lend on a three-year basis to households and to businesses. And basically they're giving it away well cheaper than anyone else.
The market, yeah.
And so and what happened in Europe is they introduced that first, and then they just made it lower and lower and lower, and now they're at the stage of paying the banks 1% just so the banks will lend. Yeah. That's where, and so that's the actual, in terms of businesses and the property market, that's the only rate that matters in Europe. Whether they raise rates or lower rates doesn't really matter if they're going to keep up with this. Their one's called the LTRO.
That's just exactly right. And the other component of it is kind of qualitative, and that is like the number of assets or the proportion of bank assets that they will buy. So they keep reducing the price, but they keep raising the ceiling on how much of the bank they'll buy. So this is why you're effectively nationalising them over time. But you're absolutely right. The TFF is now monetary policy.
So just on that, just before we shift over to a couple of questions on property, so obviously you mentioned there bond being a bond bull, and you know this I guess this direction we're headed, you know, following in the European footsteps. Did we see a big, you know, last hurrah in the bond market? As the European banks sort of headed in that direction well before us, fellas?
Actually, more than the last hurrah. I mean, they've gone to negative rates. Like, you know, that's but now that's and deeply negative. Like, you know, that you can get 10-year German government bonds. I think it's almost 1%, negative 1% now. So it's so maybe, you know, if we're truly headed in that direction, and you're happy to buy bonds that will lose you money in the future, then there's a chance for capital gain.
Yes. Well, my answer is yes. That's the way we're going.
Yeah.
It may be that the RBA has to wait because it's so reactionary. It may have to wait for the Federal Reserve to go negative before it does it.
Well, I noticed today
it will have no choice. That's what this path does.
Yep.
Yeah. The Bank of England, David, I don't know if you saw the Bank of England overnight came out telling its banks to start having a look at their books to see what, get ready. Tell us what's going to go wrong if we give you negative rates, so you've got a bit of a chance to fix your software first before we surprise you.
So this is the last bond bull market.
It's like the Y2K bug for banking, basically. They just go. All right, couple of questions on property here. So I'll kick off with this one. What percentage downside do you envision in property in Melbourne? And then also another one, just to follow on from that, will it go down in all sectors or just units, gents?
Definitely the market's most exposed. We're already seeing, and this was up until last month, unit rents in Melbourne have already fallen by about 5%. And given the profile of the dwelling construction to come, which is concentrated quite heavily in units, and also the big collapse in population growth, I'm expecting... and also the fact that investors are more concentrated in the unit market, I think will bear the brunt. And also, I think just because of the whole COVID-19 thing, units are less attractive now as places to live. I think people, they'll not only be a flight out of the inner city into the suburbs and into also the regions, they'll also be a flight away from units. The downside for the unit market is quite big. For the detached house market, not nearly as big. If I had to put it, like, Melbourne house prices are already down, dwelling values are already down 6% from peak, according to CoreLogix, and so 6% since March, effectively. And I think they'll go double digits, but beyond that, who knows? I think they'll definitely hit 10% down, and but given all lower interest rates and collapse in responsible lending rules and whatever, it should probably bottom out.
Leads do more downside than that.
Oh yeah, no. Certainly units will be more, but I think so dwelling values overall, 10% ish, could be a bit more. But at the same time, it's probably going to be the last hurrah for property, because if interest rates fall, mortgage rates are already falling down about 2%. You can get 2% rates. I mean, how much lower can they go? Maybe 1%.
Half is what's happening in Europe at the moment.
Maybe we might even get to 0.5%, but I think Dave wrote a piece last week, I think it was, about how this is the last this could be the last property boom, because it gets to a point where the rates will get as low as they can possibly get, and then after that and the banks are effectively nationalized and et cetera.
Yeah, exactly right.
Anyone listening, take this with a very low confidence, because the property market's nuts. And it's always changing, and I see more downside for Melbourne, but I don't know how much.
Very good. Okay, well, look, before we jump across to the investment outlook, I might just finish on one last one from a listener, Bob. I won't expand on the rest of his name. Is there anything Australians can do? Irritate politicians, start a riot, join a group. Citizens don't seem to matter much in Australia these days. Any notes there, fellas?
We try and provoke a riot pretty much every day. it doesn't seem to work. But any kind of protest you can bring together is good.
Yep.
Yeah. I guess
the problem is really that a lot of these policy settings, although certainly not this budget, this is a bit of a departure in terms of bipartisanship. But the problem to date, at least, has been bipartisanship in the policies that matter. Change things. Protesters has effectively had no political outcomes.
Let's take energy policy as a good one, isn't it, Dave? It's pretty much nothing between them, and they both contributed to the stuff ups, and so neither of them have an interest in bringing it to light or fixing it. Certainly, from a gas policy.
Certainly while Labor was in power.
Yeah,
I think they held back and they might do it differently, but yes, absolutely, through Brad Gillard and then into the coalition, it was the same. Yes.
It's basically...
Although one obviously had a carbon pricing scheme, so the broader energy policies were different.
But gas policy.
Specific gas policy, absolutely. Same with immigration, property.
Yeah.
No reform. Banks, they've all been much of a muchness.
Yeah, and the differences, they blow up the differences to be way larger than they really are.
Yes.
They do have the differences.
Yes. Before we get to investment impacts, there's only one other thing I mentioned yet or forgot to put in as the one other headwind that is kind of uniquely Australian and has some more news flow to it today, and that is, as we push into the COVID recovery, the further into it, the more Chinese decoupling we're going to have to deal with, both in terms of falling commodity prices as China slows into a global recovery, but just politically, Australia has pretty much elected to go down a path towards the United States as a strategic partner over China, quite sensibly, mind you, but the economic implication for the next cycle is that we'll be wrestling with Chinese decoupling as well as all these other problems. And that will come to bear pretty quickly. Like, for instance, when the budget foresees the international borders reopening and tourism and students returning, they won't be coming from China. Mm. That's almost certain. In the meantime, even today, we're seeing new Chinese blocks on Australian coal. And this time it's coking coal. It's only ever been thermal coal before, which brings Queensland into that shit fight. And so you have China basically trying to divide and conquer the Australian political economy. And we have various conflicts and responses to this, but the general thrust is going to be Chinese decoupling. The political drive for that is strong in the coalition, and it's very popular with the voters, basically. I mean, the Lowe Institute survey that was done recently had 94% support for diversification of Australian exports away from China as a policy goal. Like, 94%, you never see a number like that. So, that's what the pollies will do. So that's just an extra headwind.
Very good. Okay, thanks for that, Dave. All right, we'll jump across to the investment outlook, and I'll kick it off actually with a question from the panel here that asks exactly that. How do you invest with the discussed themes over the next few years, fellas? Or maybe we'll look a little bit closer, but we can always look out further as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's difficult. I think there's a bit of scope at the moment in the in bonds. So we still think we're sort of playing more in the middle of the curve. Just because there is a bit of excitement about markets rallying and that potentially we could see the yield sort of at the longer end sort of push back up again, but we sort of feel in that sort of 5-year range there's still a fair bit of there's a bit of scope in the Australian market to take advantage there, and then hopefully if yields do go a bit higher, we'll probably then extend our maturity out and try and pick up a bit more capital gain from that.
Mm-hmm.
Stocks are difficult. Still a preference for US. We're really as Dave said, I'll have a piece out later on this afternoon just on this third quarter reporting season.
Yep.
So while the official third quarter reporting season is only kicking off, I think tomorrow we get the first one in the US. There has actually been a bunch of companies with different balance dates that have reported over the last month or so. There's about 50 or so in sort of the MSCI world, 50 of the large cap ones. And so we're really sort of paying attention to that, because what we're thinking with in terms of the stocks is that the third quarter is going to be pretty close to life as we know it under coronavirus. Your first quarter, we didn't have coronavirus for most of it. Second quarter, we're all into lockdowns and shutdowns, and everything was all sort of, countries were trying to put in these new measures. Whereas the third quarter, starting from sort of that June, July, August, or July, August, September quarter, you really have seen, this is what we're in for. Countries are sort of semi-open, things are sort of getting back to normal, but not normal. And until we see, a fair bit of movement on the vaccine, which could easily be years away. This is life as we know it, and so we're very much watching that. And to date, it's you are seeing that, I guess, the K-shaped recovery is the key one, where things that are in consumer-facing sort of the consumer staples companies. So your supermarkets and those types of companies, they've been reporting quite well. A lot of the tech companies have been reporting quite well. But then outside that, it gets pretty hairy. And certainly, so we're sort of looking at that. We're also looking a lot at how far away companies are from where they hit in 2019. And David alluded a little bit to that earlier, but you look through the Australian market and it's looking like it's going to do about, the median company is going to be down about 20% next year. So the 2021 earnings are going to be 20% below 2019 earnings still, whereas the US is actually looking like the median company is going to be back to its 2019 earnings by next year. That probably doesn't include some tax hikes if Biden gets in. So there is room to move on that. But equity markets are certainly very expensive. But we're very focused on really what's going on at the ground level and sort of really getting into those. Into those reporting numbers and seeing where there are companies that you can actually pick up that have pretty decent outlooks, regardless of coronavirus or not.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks very much. Anything further to add, gents?
No, that's pretty much a wrap.
All pretty good. Not gonna push this new political movement that seems to be growing on your site, fellas. Just
bring it on. I have to go get out there and do something. I mean, we would, but we're a bit busy,
but yeah, we're sort of stuck in lockdown too, so under house arrest.
Sorry, what's I've lost you guys. What are we talking about?
There's some gyrations on a new political party that's been muted in the comments of macro business recently.
All right,
been following with Ernest. So anyway, it sort of fell into place with a question there earlier about what should we be doing going forward. I thought it might have come up, but anyway.
I think it's called the Australian Bullshit Party or something.
I wasn't going to say it, but anyway, yep. Thanks for that, David. Yep. All right, very good. Oh, look, thanks very much, gents. And that leads us to our question of the week. So the viewer question of the week today is, do you think this budget is setting Australia up for long-term success, or in fact, has it sabotaged our chances? Feel free to drop in your answers in the question, in the comments below. And we can work through those and take it from there. Thanks again, gents, for your time today. A terrific run-through of what appears to be a bit of an ordinary budget. But anyway, we'll have plenty to chat around its effects as they start to fall into the economy. Coming up next week, we have, Professor Steve Keen back on the show, live from Thailand. This week, Thursday, with a focus on a slightly different topic for Nucleus Investment Insights. It's climate change. Steve has recently penned a journal article in his terms, appallingly bad neoclassical economics of climate change and the current economic models of the effects of global warming that have been drastically underestimated. Yeah, he joins us on the show to discuss his thoughts on the pitfalls that emerge when mainstream economists potentially undercook the impacts and the subsequent risks for global demand shocks, including world stock markets. So that's, of course, this week, this Thursday, 12:30 p.m. live on the 15th of October. And head over to nucleuswealth.com/webinar to ask questions to have them answered along the way. So thanks again for... Of course, anyone that's popped in a terrific amount of questions today. So that's been a wonderful amount of input. And thanks very much for following in live. We hope you've enjoyed it and gotten something out of it. And of course, if you want to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. We always appreciate guest or topic suggestions. So if you've got one, please drop them in the comments of today's YouTube video. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, feel free to share with a friend, let them know about it, and help our show grow. So on that note, thanks very much for tuning in, and we'll look forward to catching you on Thursday. Cheers.